Memo on the 15-year anniversary of the Business Owner Fund, published on Tuesday, the 7th of November, 2023. You may have missed it, but the Business Owner Fund turned 15 on the 30th of September, 2023. I wrote on the occasion of the 10-year anniversary that I had been expecting extensive coverage of the occasion, but regrettably, the FT was having a busy news day. With the 15th anniversary now having also passed without much fanfare, I'm starting to think I may be alone in recognizing the earth-shattering importance of these historic milestones. Joking apart, the way I've chosen to celebrate these markers in time has been by publishing a memo on some of the most important lessons that I learned over the prior 5 years. I'm happy to continue the tradition here. But first, a look back. In my five-year memo, I wrote about how I became an independent fund manager. 5 years into a multi-decade project may seem a bit premature to start spilling the beans on the secret sauce. However, I felt and feel like I had stumbled upon a wonderful formula, and like any decent person who has had exceptional luck, I was keen to share it. Perhaps if my setup had been the result of strategic acumen or intellectual brilliance on my part, I would have been inclined to keep my cards closer to my chest. However, as I outline in the memo, many of the decisions I made, such as working alone, keeping costs at a bare minimum, and eschewing marketing, were made out of necessity. It was thanks to the positive feedback loop I inadvertently experienced that I kept doing things the same way. In my 10-year memo, I describe my journey as an investor and, in particular, two key transitions. The first transition was from an investor who was narrowly focused on more quantitative metrics around an investment opportunity to an investor who paid much closer attention to the overall quality of a business. The second transition was to an investor who paid closer attention to the quality of the people running a business than just the business itself. Of course, neither of the ideas underpinning these transitions were particularly original. For example, whenever you speak with an entrepreneur, the first thing they will tell you is that it's all about the people. The application of these ideas to value investing, however, was. They went somewhat against the grain of what people considered to be value investing then, and perhaps, to a certain extent, still do. The present. This brings us bang up to the present and the 15-year memo. Its topic is how hard it is to beat the market in the long term, why this is the case, and, you will be relieved to hear, what countermeasures an investor can take. The last 5 years have been the toughest of my investing career, and this, no doubt, influenced the choice of subject matter. The lessons, though, are relevant to any phase of an investing career. Let me start the discussion by posing a question. Imagine you had to bet your life on a single investor beating the market over a long period of time. Who would it be? There's a catch, though. You cannot choose Warren Buffett. I have been investing for over 20 years, have made hundreds of investments, and know many, if not most, of the world's most highly thought of investors, some intimately. Despite this, I would not accept the bet. And for the avoidance of doubt, this includes if I were permitted to bet on myself. It begs the question, what makes investing so difficult that not even a small minority can be certain of beating the market before the fact? Side note, obviously plenty of investors will beat the market looking back. It's an important question as, obviously, whatever the bottleneck is to beating the market is where investors should direct their energy. In my view, the bottleneck is not that the basic tenets of investing are not well documented and well understood. We are not eagerly waiting for someone finally to publish the definitive book on value investing. Good investing involves finding a business whose long-term cash flows can be forecast with a reasonable degree of certainty and paying less for it than it is worth. It's as simple as that. I feel quite certain that in 100 years' time, there will be no innovation that somehow undermines or supersedes this simple truth. Yes, you might argue, but analyzing a business's long-term earnings potential is easier said than done. Isn't it there that investors should focus their energy? If investing were a contest in which a limited number of investment opportunities had to be assessed at a single point in time, then that would no doubt be the case. However, the choice of investments is unlimited, or at least greater than any single person could ever analyze, and an investor can take as much time as they want before making an investment decision. If an investor feels unable to value a company, they can simply move on to the next one, or wait till such a point in time where they feel they can. In such a contest, the advantage from intellectual acumen is unlikely to be decisive. The actual bottleneck. So if the wrong mental model or a lack of intellectual acumen is not why people fail to beat the market, what is? In my view, it is the sheer difficulty of remaining rational, i.e. buying businesses for less than they are worth and selling them for more than they are worth, when being constantly bombarded with market gyrations, news flow, social media, expert opinions, and any number of other influences. This is not something that I, or likely anyone, is immune to. Over the last 5 years, I likely became too optimistic in some of my assumptions as the bull market approached its peak in 2021. That the emotions interfere with rational thought is not an original idea. The definitive book on psychological biases has already been written, Thinking Fast and Slow by Israeli-American Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman. In the book, the author describes many psychological biases, including the commitment bias, the tendency to stick with a decision even when it's no longer in one's best interest, likely to remain consistent with previous choices, and the sunk cost fallacy, the tendency to continue to invest in a project based on resources already committed rather than the expected future benefit. The question for us investors is how we apply the lessons from this book in order to improve our chances of beating the market. The first thing we need to do, in my view, is narrow the list of biases down to the ones most likely to hinder our chances of success. The book lists many biases, some important in an investing context, others less so. Some destructive to investment success, others potentially also less so. Side note, if investors generally trade too much, is commitment bias such a bad thing? In practice, there are two main failings resulting from emotional biases that an investor needs to eliminate: turning overly pessimistic when markets or investments are down, and turning overly optimistic when they are up. Perhaps it could even be argued that turning overly pessimistic when markets are down is the key risk to be cognizant of. Assuming markets trend upwards over time, albeit in a lumpy fashion, the single most important attribute in an investor is the ability to remain steadfast when the outlook temporarily looks bleak. However, given how damaging to wealth it can be to be caught up in a bubble, I will leave the list at two. The second thing we need to do is give the topic the attention it deserves. Investors tend to view the study of psychological biases as an adjunct to good investing, not a core component. Despite the extensive body of research in behavioral finance, the pantheon of books on investing is largely made up of books that discuss the nature of markets. Spoiler alert, they occasionally do crazy things. What makes a good company? Spoiler alert 2, a growing moat. And when to buy it? Spoiler alert 3, when it is trading for less than it's worth. These are of course important things to understand, but given an abundance of intelligent and motivated investors out there, they are unlikely to provide any competitive differentiation, although you would of course be at a disadvantage if you did not understand them. To overstate my case only slightly, if I were to teach a 10-class course on investing, the first 9 classes would be about how the market and other factors mess with your ability to think clearly. In the 10th, I would say, oh, by the way, this is how you build a DCF model, and this is what constitutes a moat. Please do not ask me how to teach that course, though. The only way to understand what markets can do to your mental faculties is to experience it. Just because something cannot be taught in a classroom, though, does not mean it is unimportant. This is why my first piece of advice to anyone interested in becoming an investor is to open a brokerage account. If your employer forbids it, you may want to seek out a new job. The bottom line. In a nutshell, this is what I am arguing. There are tens of thousands of diligent, talented, and motivated business analysts and investors in the world. But there is only one that I feel completely sure will make better than average investment decisions irrespective of what the market throws at him. Buffett. Countermeasures. On this somber note, let's move on to a more upbeat topic. What can we do to add our names to this list of one? As it happens, a lot. Some of these things I do well, others less so. So this is written as much for my benefit as for yours. One, recognize the nature of the game. It is important to recognize what the nature of competition is and set priorities accordingly. If the challenge is to outsmart all the other investors, then obviously you would want to sharpen your analytical capability. If, on the other hand, the challenge is to keep an even keel when everyone else is losing their heads, this calls for a different set of priorities. As you probably guessed, I believe the latter is more important than the former. If so, you need to prioritize thinking clearly over all else. The remainder of this memo provides some ideas on what you can do. 2. Seek independence. I cannot overstate the importance of being independent. It is far easier to reach a rational conclusion about any topic if your thought process is unclouded by the opinions of others. In the 1950s, Solomon Asch conducted a series of psychological experiments known as the Asch Conformity Experiments. A group of 8 participants engaged in a simple perceptual task whereby all but one of the participants were actors. Each participant was shown a card with one line on it, followed by another card with 3 lines of differing lengths on it. See image. The task was to state which line was of similar length, a simple task that everyone got right when left to their own devices. The catch is that in some trials, the actors gave the wrong response. When this happened, the study subject was far more likely to give the wrong response as well. The research suggests people are more likely to conform than they might expect. Furthermore, the study found that people are more likely to conform when A, more people are present, B, the task is more difficult, and C, the other members of the group are of higher social status. And they're also less likely to conform when able to respond privately. This suggests to me 4 ways to increase your chances of thinking independently. Avoid large groups, stick to simple investment opportunities, avoid experts and gurus, and make investment decisions in private, i.e. not in a committee. It is fascinating to me that 3 of these 4 measures suggest working alone is better than in a team, and the 4th, keeping it simple, is independent of team size. All the evidence suggests that the smaller the team size, the better. 3. Research ideas thoroughly. Thorough research is vital. There's nothing too controversial in that statement. The reason, however, perhaps is. It is not to figure out whether an investment makes sense. A good investment idea should be obvious. If hundreds of hours of research are necessary to figure out whether an investment is worthwhile, it is likely not. The purpose of research is to have the emotional fortitude to stay the course when an investment is going against you. When an investment is doing poorly, someone is going to forward you an article saying something along the lines of, "The largest customer is about to insource," or "Amazon with its bottomless pockets is planning on entering the market," or more simply, "The company is a fraud." If you have not put in the long hours of research, when this happens, you will panic and head for the hills. But are not several pairs of eyes better than one, you might ask, when it comes to building a 360-degree view of a company? Of course. There is no rule, though, that you cannot collaborate with other people when it comes to research. The investment decision, however, needs to be made independently. 4. Kiss lots of frogs. Given that a good investment idea should be obvious, but the analysis before investing needs to be detailed, it stands to reason that the optimal approach is to analyze many ideas superficially and a handful, the ones considered for investment, in depth. In other words, it is necessary to kiss lots of frogs until you find a prince. The investment blog, Value and Opportunity, occasionally takes an entire stock market and analyzes every company in it. I'm a big fan of the idea. The blogger's reasons for rejecting an investment sometimes amount to just a single sentence, so these entries won't win any prizes for their intricacy. However, to the end of creating as many free options as possible, it is great. 5. practice negative and positive visualization. I have derived a lot of benefit from negative visualization, i.e., visualizing how I would feel if there was a negative news story about a company that I am invested in and the share price tanked. If I would feel uncomfortable, then it is probably not a company I should be investing in. As every company experiences negative news flow and stock price declines at some point, it is an exercise that is well worth doing ahead of time. It helps to prepare psychologically for what is likely to be a stressful experience and increases the chances of keeping a cool head. The most painful investing experience is when you lose money. So when it comes to visualization, I tend to practice the negative variant. Positive visualization is also important though, especially when there is an excess of pessimism. Today, for example, there is a lot of pessimism around China for all the reasons you'll be familiar with. China, though, is a country with an educated, hardworking population and lots of catch-up potential to Western living standards. There will be a time, perhaps even in our lifetimes, when there is considerably more optimism than there is today. Visualizing such a time helps, perhaps, to put the current mood in perspective and seize what could be a historic investment opportunity. 6. Build a supportive capital base. It is vital to have a loyal and supportive capital base. Without one, it is very difficult to stay the distance, no matter how good your intentions. I saw firsthand in the Great Financial Crisis how many funds folded because their investors panicked and redeemed their capital at the bottom of the market. In many cases, the reason the funds folded was not poor investment decisions on the part of the managers. The investments did fine over time. They failed because they had taken capital from the wrong people. At the other extreme, I have also seen funds fail because they received too much capital at the top of the market. When the inevitable downturn happens, they find themselves in a situation where most of the investors in their fund have had a bad experience, even though the long-term track record is perfectly respectable. This leads to potentially catastrophic outflows if the fund has built up a cost base commensurate with the higher level of assets under management. 7. Do not post on social media. If the name of the game is to keep an even keel despite what is happening around you, I cannot for the life of me imagine how having a prominent social media presence can improve investment returns. Social media tends to amplify whatever emotions are prevalent at the time. When returns are good, you are likely to be celebrated as the next Warren Buffett. When they are bad, you will be pummeled mercilessly. An ideal environment is the exact opposite. One where you receive gentle encouragement when things are going badly and a reality check when things are going well. I realize that building a prominent social media presence is an effective way to raise capital fast. But if you live by the sword, expect to die by the sword. 8. Meditate? I do not meditate. Nothing will more assuredly send me into a coma-like sleep than a comfortable seating position and the sounds of pebbles washing up against a beach. I know a lot of accomplished investors, however, that do. Hey, Josh. The mental state of autonomy and equanimity that I understand meditation engenders strikes me as conducive to good investment decisions. Perhaps I should give it another try. Worst case scenario, I will be well rested before making any new investment decisions. 9. Take a long-term view. The single best way I have found to evaluate whether something is important or not is to consider whether I will care about it or even remember it in 10 years' time. Changes in interest rates, disappointing quarters, and even recessions are things that people will likely not care about in 10 years' time. A customer exodus, the breach of debt covenants, and a disruptive new entrant possibly are. Looking through the lens of how things will appear in the future helps to separate signal from the noise. Note, though, it is only possible to practice long-term thinking if you have capital providers who take a similarly long-term perspective. 10. Be humble. The final point is the importance of humility. Markets occasionally do unexpected things, and the best investment strategies ultimately fail as competitors imitate them. Anyone who thinks they have everything figured out is riding for a fall. It is important to be humble. You have read on two occasions in this memo that it is not clear to me whether I will beat the market in the long term. This is not forced humility. I believe it, not just because of the sobering experience of the last 5 years, but for the simple reason that so few investors do beat the market over the long term. Why should I be the chosen one? I hope this is not too disconcerting to my investors. It should not be. Even Buffett is circumspect about Berkshire's ability to continue to beat the market given its enormous scale, though he would no doubt fancy his chances with a smaller capital base. Anyone who is certain they are going to beat the market belongs in the marketing department, not the investment department. That's it for now. See you in 5 years' time for the 20-year memo. In the meantime, thanks for listening and happy investing.